UWA-517, do you want to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Merge 1095. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Do we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there. Same airplanes.
And it is such. Bob, I swear to God, four calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
Four calls
on an unidentified flying object.
Let's not take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com.
Hello and welcome to the show, everyone. How are you all? Doing good, I hope. Our guest today is Gary Voorhees Jr., and Gary is a first-hand witness to the USS Nimitz Tic Tac UFO events of November of 2004. He has a background in mechanical engineering and working as an electronic and RF technician. He was a fire controlman and an Aegis Computer CFC technician in the United States Navy. During his time on the USS Princeton, he had the task of security and inventory of top secret and classified information and materials, including being trained on the WASP military recon UAV for the Pacific Fleet during Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom. Gary is co-founder and president of UAP Expeditions and a speaker at this year's Contact in the Desert 2021's virtual event. And if you are interested in virtually attending this year to see many great speakers such as Gary and others, I have teamed up with the wonderful organizers of Contact in the Desert to get listeners of this show a discount on tickets. Discount promo code can be found in the show notes of this episode and on my website, so I hope you can join us. Okay, Gary Voorhees up next.
If you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to www.patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode below. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I really appreciate you coming on today and sharing this for our listeners.
Hey, no problem. I try to make myself available.
Okay. Now, Gary, take us back to November of 2004, if you would. Would you like to start off a little bit about yourself and then what you experienced, please, Gary?
Well, I went into the service in 99. I went through boot camp, then electronic school, then fire control A school, which is your general studies in the job field that you have, and then I went through a specialty school for the specific system that I was going to be running, Aegis Computers, became an Aegis Computer technician, and then was assigned to the USS Princeton. Then in September of 2004. In broad strokes, we tracked unknown aircraft for 7 days, and at the end of that period of time, there was an F-18 interrogation of it, where we filmed one of these unknown objects, which is now the famous Tic Tac video that everybody's seen, or, well, everybody in the UFO world's seen. Then, in specifically more detail, back in September, I was sitting outside smoking a cigarette and then talking with one of the other Aegis technicians, and he was telling us about having anomalous tracks, or, well, possibly some non-tracks. So we have to, you know, see if it's clutter or something like that. And then we eventually went through and went through our computer systems, went through everything, make sure everything was running up and up, make sure everything was right. And no matter what we changed or we did, we still had these tracks. So we had these solid tracks coming down out of Catalina, the channel between Catalina Island and California, and going due south, basically along the coastline towards Baja, doing around 100 knots. They weren't really doing anything spectacular. They weren't, you know, I mean, that was honestly a bit slow for most flying objects. That was a bit curious. I assume that, you know, at that time there was still a stigma with, you know, UFOs and reporting them. So I assume most of the ignorance or the action towards finding out what they were was mostly due to not wanting to be, you know, the captain or the crew that was tracking aliens, or, you know, nobody wants those nicknames. So tracking unknown aircraft. We were all very surprised that there's just really nothing going on for, like, after that first day where we had to just make sure what we were seeing was real. There really wasn't anything going on for quite a while. My routine basically was check our location and bearing in combat, see location and bearing of one of the tracks, and go try and look at it. And depending on who was on watch at the time, I might be able to get up there and take a peek. And sometimes I didn't. And so sometimes on the very edge of the horizon, especially after dark, I could, see the objects at a distance. And that was basically the same routine over and over again until I was told that there was an interrogation and that there was a film that we could see, you know, that we could go watch it. And I'm like, oh, and I just for some reason assumed it was live at the time, but now it's looking like it wasn't live. But after, you know, thinking back on it, no, I shouldn't have had any reason to think it was live. But we did go up and watch this video, and I remember when the video was done, I remember feeling that kind of faint kind of feeling where you're a little nervous in your stomach, and your head's a little numb, and you're not quite processing it very well. And then after seeing it the second time, you know, I noticed that it's got, you know, a universal heat signature, no flight surfaces, no wings, no propellers. It's colder than the air around it. These things started to kind of register and blow my mind, you know. So then they didn't make a big deal about it. You know, we didn't end up signing any non-disclosures or any agreements like that. We had a gentleman come on board and confiscate the tapes from my data recording on my computer systems. And then after that was the end of everything for me, other than just, you know, what I'd think about in my head for the next, you know, 17 years until the New York Times did an article about it. And then from that point on, so the New York Times did their article, and then Commander Fravor came out publicly about the event. And, you know, then it was, you know, then it had to be real. You know, it was actually a real thing. You know, at that point, it wasn't just, it could have been something, and we weren't quite sure, you know, what really happened those days. And then now we are, you know, thankfully the United States government has come out and said that, yes, these things were real. Yes, we don't know what they were, and we still don't know what they are. And just because we had a lot of those unanswered questions and we didn't have all the data that, you know, was available due to, you know, either, you know, the government having that information and not really sharing it, We formed the company UAPX, me and Kevin Day. And from there, we got a team of, you know, mostly ex-military and scientists. You know, we've got a team consisting of me, Kevin Day, Michael Hall, which is an attorney, which some in our world know as the paranormal lawyer. Jason Turner, which is one of our shipmates that was there the day. He was also a witness to the actual, you know, full-length video. We've gotten Kevin Knuth, Christopher Altman, and Matthew Zayegas, PhDs, respectively, mostly in physics. Matthew is a dark matter specialist and radiation detection specialist. Christopher Altman is a trained NASA astronaut and, you know, a physicist himself. And then, of course, Kevin Knuth is, you know, a physicist in science and technology and quantum physics. And then we've got David Mason, which is our basically a mechanical engineer slash electronic engineer. Then Jerry McGowan, which everybody's familiar with, and his lovely vehicle for us to exploit. And then last but not least, David Altman, which basically, you know, he does a lot of field researcher and does field investigations with us and, you know, smooths over some things with some Hollywood types since he's, you know, familiar with that area. So we've got a little bit of everything to round out an amazing team. So I'm very blessed to have these people and to be able to work with these people doing, you know, these studies, and can't wait to be able to publish, you know, great work for other people to read and, you know, continue our studies on for now and in the future.
I'll put a link to UAP Expeditions down below in the description of this episode. It sounds like it's got a great team working on this.
Yeah, we've gotten, like I said, it's just, it's kind of like one of those things that it just seemed to come together, like, you know, pretty well. And I can't even imagine the situation that, you know, the series of events that happened that we were able to get this team to come together. So, you know, like I said, I'm just blessed to have them, you know, working for us.
Let's go back to the video as well. When they actually showed you the video, what was the general atmosphere with you yourself and your colleagues on viewing this?
Well, we were, you know, we were logging in and looking at it ourselves. It wasn't being shown to us. But we were, you know, in general, just kind of, in awe, you know, and I don't think there wasn't a really a whole lot of talk about it just because it was that specific, you know, you could see what you were looking at and just, it was hard to process. So there wasn't a whole lot of talk.
Was there a wow factor?
Yeah. Yeah. You could say that. Definitely a wow factor. It was, like I said, like the first run through, I mean, you just go numb watching it because it's just so surrealistic. You know, it's like, you know, is this something somebody made? Is this real? Is this the actual intercept? You know, you just keep asking that same question over and over again, you know, and it's always the same answer. Yes, 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 yes. It's real. Yes, it's the intercept. This is the actual footage from the FLIR pod. Yeah. So it was surreal. It was very surreal.
And you were in charge of some very, very sophisticated equipment.
Yes. The Aegis computer system, which runs, it's the mainframes that run all of the weapon systems aboard the ship. And we also run all the data recording for all of the metadata, all of the system specifics, the how the systems are working, the diagnostics, everything gets recorded on our system.
There's definitely a lot of detail in there. And it can basically pick up just about anything, right? That equipment.
It's radar resolution, which is like something some people might be familiar with. Is basically through software, we're able to filter out, like, you know, anything that's not a plausible track, i.e., like crests of waves and things like that. But the resolution detail is fine enough for us to determine, you know, if a periscope pops up above the water, we can see it. So, I mean, then that's a pretty small object. I mean, so it's, it's a pretty amazing system. Even, you know, even for today's standards, it was still pretty amazing.
And so much detail as well you can actually pick up. It's a bit like alien radar, really, isn't it?
Oh, that was kind of the before this event, when we were going through school, we always referred to it as alien technology because it was so crazy how well it worked and so the way it worked.
I think there's a little bit of irony in there.
Yeah, I thought so too.
What was your stand on this type of thing before kind of got embroiled in all this?
Well, I get the question a lot where, you know, were you into this type of thing before this happened? And I'm like, it's hard to answer that because, you know, I did enjoy TV shows like The X-Files and things like that, but so did millions of people. But I think I was just generally interested in anything. You know, I just, if there was something that interested me, I would become fascinated with it and just, just kind of study everything I could get my hands on at the time and just kind of like an OCD, information collector.
And it also sounds like you were perfect for that job in any case. Obviously the mathematics side of it, you know, the data side, you know, so you sound like you were perfect to be doing that job.
I don't know if I was perfect, but I definitely enjoyed it. And, it's just, with everything going on, you couldn't have asked for a better situation for me, at least, because it was, you know, gave me a very clear and concise answers to questions I had, you know, just in general relativity and how things work. And, for me, when I saw the abilities of these crafts, it was an amazing time for me because it opened up a whole new world of, you know, what was possible and where, you know, a lot of people kind of get hung up on the what the videos did, what the videos didn't do. But the video itself isn't really all that great. And, you know, everybody can admit that video is a compressed mess. But it is the first video that the government has clearly stated that, yes, this is an unknown object. That it also clearly shows the uniform heat signatures, the fact that it was colder than the air around it. It also, you know, it gave us a lot of metadata that you can just visually see that was amazing. You know, and then you have the firsthand accounts of people like myself and you know, Commander Fravor and Kevin Day and, you know, Sean Cahill, that actually saw the flight characteristics of these objects and could tell you, you know, our radar data tells us how fast it's capable of going, if not faster, you know. So all these things combined make this just, and, you know, it was just an outstandingly just mind-blowing situation. And if everybody stood back and just kind of really looked at it, it really is just mind-blowing.
And it's also a big stepping stone as well.
Absolutely. Any time the government actually admits anything is a stepping stone. I'm still waiting for them to admit hammers don't cost $20,000. Yeah. But, you know, hey, one step at a time, right?
One step at a time. Okay. Now, you said that the data was confiscated.
Well, I say confiscated because it sounds better, but really it was just collected, because anytime there's an incident, whether it's a downed aircraft, a man overboard or, you know, anything that happens where they might be able to use that data, it's going to be collected because generally in around about the same manner type, because like when we had a downed aircraft during a deployment at one point, you know, the same things happened. So I don't think it was too out of the ordinary. The only thing that's kind of out of the ordinary is back then I just handed my tapes off to my superior and then they just would go wherever they were going to go. In this situation, I actually had to sign a chain of custody and hand them to somebody. So that was about the only big difference. So that's kind of why I feel like they were more confiscated rather than, just collected.
And then was it an internal organization?
Well, I wouldn't really know who they were a part of. They did come in on a military helicopter, but they, you know, they were wearing civilian clothes. So, you know, your guess is as good as mine of what department, agency, or, you know, it could have been as benign as they were literally just tech reps coming in to pull the data to analyze how the performance of the equipment. You know, I don't unfortunately have that answer because all the leads to try to find out who they were are kind of general dead ends because I didn't know them personally.
Sure.
I knew a lot of the tech reps for our system since I was there when they were installed, and I didn't recognize any of them, but they've got, you know, hundreds of people working in those divisions. So it very well could have still been a tech rep.
Possibly maybe the DOD. It could, yeah, like you said, you know, it could be anyone. So they came in and just, you just handed it over.
I'm sure Elizondo's group didn't just, you know, roll around in uniform. So, you know, ATIP at the time was, you know, was probably the people that came in and investigated it. I've got no idea. And that's just a in the dark guess, because I've never gotten confirmation from Lou that if they did investigate us or not. I'm assuming they did, since that was literally their job. But
and they obviously took all the data, all the tapes, took everything. And
yeah,
so no copies or any of that kind of stuff would have been made.
No. As a matter of fact, we were told to, you know, record over any tapes that were left in the computer room just in case, so that everything had so they have a timestamp on them when they're made. So everything would have a timestamp from that day forward. So they knew for a fact that there would be no data on it from the event. And to have one of those tapes, if you had them, it would be a federal offense and you would be arrested and sent to prison.
I was just wondering how thorough, you know, they would have been. Say if there would have been any blank tapes there, they would have probably just cleared them in any case, just, you know, just to make sure.
Yeah, they all had to be deleted, everything, even if they were brand new. Like, so a lot of the brand new ones still had plastic around them. We actually had to break them out and basically record nothing over the top of all of them.
And was that usual protocol with, say, like a situation like a downed aircraft?
No.
Okay.
That definitely was not a normal protocol. That was something that I didn't, you know, like, it was just kind of like they didn't emphasize it. It was like something I didn't think was really important at the time. It was just like, oh, and, you know, delete all the, any other tapes that you might have on board, you know? And it wasn't like the tone and the mannerisms of the person that was talking to me, it didn't make me feel like it was something that I had to do because I was doing something wrong, or that, you know, that it was just a mandatory precaution, because of some data sensitivity with the system, especially because CEC was so new at the time. It was just a prototype. We couldn't even talk about it.
And have you ever heard during your time in the service of any other similar situations prior to what you experienced?
Well, I mean, we get the historical Foo Fighters. We have we had the original Princeton, that, or one of the LHC or the LHA, I think it was, that was the USS Princeton that had a UFO encounter in the Philippines. Other than that, no. I mean, things that I've read or seen, you know, a National Geographic special on, or, you know, investigation of, or, you know, or the old, you know, Leonard Nimoy's TV show. What was it? In Search of, you know. Yeah, you know, I used to love that show.
Good show.
So other than those type of things, I generally wouldn't have, I didn't have any personal experiences or didn't hear of any either. But then again, I wouldn't even have thought to ask.
Yeah, of course. So what made you kind of want to come forward with this?
Well, first I just wanted to make sure that by coming forward that there wasn't going to be any issues. So I did contact a lot of my old shipmates and just double check and make sure we didn't sign anything. Because I remember signing something, and then that's when I had confirmed that it was just a chain of custody. And so that doesn't, you know, so I could talk about the event. I just couldn't talk about ship specific stuff, you know, our capabilities and things like that. You know, I just had to talk in generalities. I just, you know, I couldn't tell you specific frequencies or, you know, power levels or, you know, I can't tell you how to build a spy radar because, you know, that would be super illegal.
I don't think I have the time.
You know, yeah, we don't have the time, you know, going over those scats would take some time. So, but the general situation that happened, I can talk about, you know, so I have, and I've done it a lot. So, and if they were going to have an issue and, you know, knock on my door, they definitely would have already done it.
Join me, George Norrie, for the Worldwide Contact in the Desert Virtual UFO Conference, June 25th to June 28th. Contact in the Desert is an epic weekend of adventure, jam-packed with exciting explorations into UFOs, ancient civilizations, AI, crop circles, forbidden archaeology, disclosure, and the newest evidence of ongoing contact, sightings, and leading-edge science. This amazing weekend delivers more than 130 presentations and special events showcasing 67 speakers from all over the world, with 2 extra weeks to view your favorite leading experts, including Avi Loeb with Clyde Lewis, Linda Moulton Howe, Paul Hellyer, John Lear, Russell Targ, David Childress, Doc Wallach, and more. With breaking articles in the New York Times and acknowledged naval sightings, and more importantly, the new release of classified documents on the day of the soft opening of Contact in the Desert, we are your source for inside information. Join us June 25th at contactinthedesert.com to get your tickets today. Make contact, contactinthedesert.com.
Because one problem I have had over the last couple of years, I receive emails from retired military individuals, you know, which I'm pretty sure they're listening right now. They want to come on the show and share, you know, what they experienced. And some of it goes back to the 70s, the 80s. But they're worried that if they did, then they could get repercussions, you know, because some of them are retired now. You know, they're receiving a form of disability benefit.
I think as long as they don't share any system specifics of even stuff back then, because, like, ironically, you know, there's some things that we're still using from the 60s and 70s. But I would say that if you've, you know, as long as you don't share specifics and didn't sign a non-disclosure about any particular event, then I'll be honest with you, I've been talking about this since, you know, 2019, and I've had nobody say anything to me at all, you know. But then again, I've also been very careful about not, you know, talking about anything that could put any of my current shipmates at risk, or our capabilities in the hands of our, you know, foreign nationals. So that's the other thing, is you just got to be real careful about what you say about the event. You know, if you just talk straight about what you witnessed, you're usually pretty good to go.
Well, I did have one guy, and this is from the 80s, and he sent me an email about his experience on board one of the ships. And he goes, I will come on a show, but I need to ask kind of permission first. So he went down all the right channels, and they just gave him a flat out no. And that was it, unfortunately.
Yeah. If you ask for permission, you're going to get a flat no. If you're still active, or you're still attached to a command of some type, like if he was, still active duty, or if he was, retired, or if he was or inactive reserve or active reserve. Yeah, if you ask permission, they're not going to tell you, yeah, go ahead and go talk all about that thing we really probably don't want you to.
The problem with it was, I knew what the outcome was going to be, but I couldn't say to him, because no, you shouldn't do that. You should just come on a show, because that's wrong. You know, the guy has to make his own choice. So hopefully, you know, if he hears this now.
Well, for me, as long as you didn't sign a non-disclosure, and as long as you don't tell any trade secrets or any capabilities of the ship, you know, because even telling the capabilities, old capabilities of a ship or a system, it can actually cause problems, because, you know, say China's interested in what we could do back then, so that they can make accusations about things that we might not have been able to do at the time. You know, I mean, it's even learning about old technologies can glean intelligence from, you know. So there's people that are, you know, there's any information about any type of U.S. system is valuable. So you just want to keep it as vague as possible about the actual systems, and just focus on the important stuff, the meat and potatoes, you know, the stuff that you need to focus on, you know. And this is already just an account, a witness account. So you have to, you either believe me or don't believe me. So if I tell you that the system could do that or it couldn't do that, you got to be happy with that. You can't ask me, how do I know that it could? Because then that's going to have to get into system specifics.
That's right.
And sometimes I can go into it a little bit, but sometimes, most of the time, I can't.
And I think, you know, there's a right way of doing stuff, isn't there? You know, at the end of the day, and of course, there is always the problem with defense in any case. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, I got to look out for my family. Yeah. I got to make sure my family's safe. So that's why I stay safe. And when in doubt, Google it. If you can Google it, you can talk about it for the most part.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay. And now you're also going to be a guest speaker at this year's Virtual Contact in the Desert.
Yeah, that's correct. Me and Kevin Day are doing a presentation about the, you know, the residual effects of the encounter, how it's affected us, our life, our personalities. We're going to go through, you know, a quick walk through the event just for those that it might be a little bit new, but we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on that. You know, we're going to talk about, you know, what we were doing in the meantime while we were waiting to, you know, have that fateful conversation that started up all of this, you know. So we're gonna go through a lot of that the after effects, you know, all the way up to the progression and, you know, the us creating UAPX petitions. So
that's great. And you know, the organizers, the contact, are a great bunch, you know. So
I know that Kevin, this will be the second year that Kevin's done it. Frankly, I just wasn't invited last year's. Or actually, I was invited for last year, but it got canceled. I wasn't invited the year before.
Well, you could be a regular show for you now, then.
I'm up for any invitations to just about anything. My limitations is just, you know, I still work a 9-to-5. You know, I got a family. I got to, you know, so obviously I can't accept everything, but I'm definitely, you know, open for it because it exposes people and they need to have exposure to, well, a little less of the to be frank, is, can I swear on this?
Yeah, that's fine.
A lot of the bullshit that goes through our community. Yeah. So it's, you know, the one thing I see is a lot of garbage. You know, I see a lot of smart people, which makes me happy. I see, you know, everything from the pessimist to the idealist to the, you know, the nuts and bolts realists. And, you know, it's, I'm happy to see them all when they're actually communicating, you know. And you'll see on, you know, Twitter, if you're, you know, one of my Twitter followers or following me on Twitter, you know, I'll get into somebody's tail for, you know, starting to get too irate about any one particular thing. Because when it comes down to it, anybody that tells you they know exactly what it is either so well written into the program that they probably wouldn't have talked to you begin with, or they really don't. Because I don't know anybody that really knows. And if they don't have real proof, it's hard for me to say they do. So, yeah, I always say beware of those that know everything.
We've actually said that on the show before. Yeah, always be aware, because chances are they don't.
Yep. Now somebody comes out with some crazy story and they got proof, you know, or at least circumstantial evidence, you know, hey, give it a shot.
I mean, a lot of the speakers at these major conferences, you know, they do have a quite a wide spectrum of experiences.
Yeah, and a lot of it I've never had a personal experience with, so I leave that to, you know, kind of the people that do that type of stuff. And, you know, I mean, granted, I personally have been studying a little bit on consciousness and, you know, some of the, you know, the odder aspects of the phenomenon. And, you know, and honestly, I've been kind of moving more towards calling all of this stuff just the phenomenon, you know, and which seems to be kind of gaining a little bit of traction, because it just kind of makes a little bit more sense to those that have fallen down the hole a little bit too far.
Can be a long drop. I mean, for years and years and years. I mean, I've been involved in this field since the mid-90s, and for years it was just purely nuts and bolts.
Well, that's all people had. You know, it was either a plasma ball or a physical object they saw. And then, of course, you had the abductees. And I mean, it's hard to take somebody that's an abductee serious, because there's little to no proof. You know, now we have people that, you know, have had implants with anomalous objects pulled out of them. They've had, you know, at least some circumstantial evidence and some, you know, a little bit of, you know, raw science behind it, you know, behind it, between psychotherapy and, you know, now hypnotism and stuff like that, I kind of am on the fence about, just because it's too easy to lead somebody in those states. But I think if done properly, that it can be used as a great tool to, you know, determine these things that happen to people, if they should want to remember them. Me personally, I don't think I would ever try to get regressed, only because the simple fact is there's no way in hell I could trust anybody enough inside my head. So my head's too, too personal for me to let anybody inside.
Now you've kind of looking at consciousness. These objects that, you know, that you saw, I'm sure you've been asked this before. What do you think they were?
Realistically, most people hate my answer, because I'm literally still on the fence about whether they were man-made or not. You know, all the people that are, you know, hardcore UFOologists, you know, that believe in aliens and extraterrestrials that are coming to the earth, they're always like, no, you know, in your heart that this is, you know, these are aliens. And then of course the other house side of the house is like, you know, this is definitely some type of black project, you know, cause either way, it makes either camp feel good. But when it comes down to it, for me, I could see our government flying against us. We have a horrible track record of testing out all kinds of things on ourselves. You know, our government and our affiliated ABC agencies and military branches have been literally psychologically, physiologically, and, you know, just every type of way been testing human beings from day one, between the CIA giving people, you know, LSD, the army gave their people LSD, untested vaccines, untested, antibiotics. There's so many different things look at the, you know, the account with the farmer that was good with crypto, and he was decrypting all these government signals and thinking he was talking to aliens, and then ended up going nuts and killing himself over it. You know, there's a lot of backtracking and stuff that kind of, so my own opinion is that I go 60-40. 40% that it could be some type of either black project or a breakaway civilization, or 60% that it may be something off world. And that could also not discount parallel universes also, you know, so even something coming from a parallel universe would technically be alien to us. So,
and an honest answer as well. And that's what, you know, that's what people shouldn't be so quick to jump to conclusions.
Well, I base all of my conclusions on my current available information. As I absorb more, as I listen to more people, have more in-depth conversations, and then do my research off of things that they say, I learn more and more and base my opinions, and they constantly change. You know, there was a one point I was certain that these had to be straight up UFO aliens. And then, you know, after learning, you know, like I said, falling down that rabbit hole a little too far, you know, I started learning some quantum physics and realizing, well, maybe it might be a parallel universe, you know, and then going from there to, you know, there's been so many different theories. I think at the current, I've got like 78 different possibilities, and all of them, sometimes they're just a variant of a different one, but generally 78 different versions of what could possibly have happened that day. Now, most of it's probably all wrong, but these are just thought lines that I went down. It's all thought experiments. So,
and anything is possible, though, isn't it? This is the thing. Anything is possible.
One of my personal sayings is anything is possible, just highly improbable.
You know, when it comes to science, you know, there's the science that we know, and there's the science that we don't know. The science we're constantly learning about and adapting, and things are changing. So, yeah, anything is possible. So.
Yeah, and honestly, the more that we're learning about our environment, our world, and things like that, it's literally looking like some of the most impossible things that we thought would just be straight science fiction could be possible.
I mean, it's also very exciting as well, because when I was a kid, because I was born in the 70s, so when I was a kid, you know, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have mobile phones, we barely had a channel on the television, a big old television.
Well, you had the Million Dollar Man.
Million Dollar Man. I mean, I was born in the late 70s, so I was kind of growing up in the early, mid-80s.
Yeah, I was born in 1980, so I was right in that same kind of epoch that you were.
Yeah, sure. So I got probably 3 years on you. So I was growing up with, like, the Incredible Hulk.
Mm-hmm. G.I. Joe. A-Team.
G.I. Joe, Knight Rider.
Oh, I loved Airwolf.
You know, it had a great theme. I was arguing with someone on Facebook the other day about the best 80s theme tunes. He said Street Hawk.
I don't think I'm familiar with that one.
That's the motorbike one. It's on YouTube. You want to check it out. Street Hawk.
Then you had Knight Rider. I tell you what, that was, I tell you, I heard, if you heard that intro, you knew what was on.
It was a great one.
Yeah.
It was a great, I mean, he was saying Street Hawk, but I was saying the Equalizer, the old Edward Woodward Equalizer.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Yeah, I grew up in all that stuff too. Yeah, I loved it.
And it was, to be honest, it was great. You know, I wouldn't want to be a kid these days, but in those days, it was great. Everyone was so excited. And we had a lot of American stuff on television. You know, we had all those great TV shows, which I still watch to this day. We had all this stuff about NASA. So everything was exciting in those days.
Oh, yeah. Anything NASA did was like, that was crazy. It was, when we would go to class, if there was a launch or if there was anything going on, we were watching it in class, you know? So it was pretty awesome. Unfortunately, that includes when the Challenger blew up, but you know, that's, you know, something only our generation would really.
Yeah. Remember it well.
Remember it well.
Yeah. I had a lump in my throat that day. I remember it well. I mean, I had a NASA t-shirt. I had a NASA trucker hat, you know, it was great. I mean, kids these days, you know, they just don't seem half as interested in that kind of thing as we were.
Well, I mean, my whole goal for my entire like young childhood to my mid-teens was trying to go to space camp.
I remember that was an 80s movie as well.
Yeah. Space camp. Yeah. After I saw that movie, that was it. And then, of course, you had the Disney movie that came out. Was it The Navigator or Flight of the Navigator?
Flight of the Navigator, yeah.
Oh, that was, man, that silver ship. God, I'm like, yeah, that's got to be what they look like. Look at that. Yeah, look at the interface. It's got to be neural like that. You know, I remember thinking that as a child. Like, I was so fascinated with how the technology worked. I'm like, yeah, definitely. You know, bioneural. Yeah, got to be. You know, and I was like, and my friends are like, what the hell are you talking about? What? Yeah, it was cool. It was shiny. I'm like, oh, no. How it works, guy. That's, you know. So, yeah, I remember being that way. No wonder I didn't have that many friends. Huh.
Yeah, it was you and me both. I love that film. Flight of the Navigator. That was, it must have been the early 80s that was.
Yeah.
All the little aliens and stuff. And
the dystopian future stuff really got me. Did you ever see Solar Babies?
No, I never saw that.
Yeah, that was another one. That was, just basically dystopian future and a bunch of teenage kids just kind of doing it. They find a alien orb and, you know, it changes their lives, that type of deal. You know, I thought it was a pretty good one.
Yeah, no, I've just made a note of that because I do check on you. There's a lot of good stuff on YouTube, you know, the old stuff.
Yeah. You can find just about anything online now. Worst case scenario, it might cost you a couple of bucks if it's old.
Got it. Okay. So I think that's just about a wrap then.
All right, bud. Appreciate you having me on, man. Anytime if you have any follow-up questions or even if this generates questions with your listeners, I'll answer everything the best of my abilities. Sorry if I don't have as in-depth knowledge as some of the people might want to have or be able to go into the nitty-gritty of the specific system requirements and settings and stuff like that. But
the point of this show is just about your personal experience. You know, I've done quite a few episodes now and people's experiences, they do range. Sometimes they can be quite bizarre, you know, to something quite, you know, quite benign, just normal lights in the sky. You know, I don't discriminate between people's experiences. You know, I got a lot of people send me constant emails, a lot of fans of the show that just want to share something that they've never shared before. And I've had guests on here which have never, ever spoken about what experienced. And some of them can go back 40, 50 odd years.
Yeah, that's a good format. I wish I had, you know, gotten on here before I'd done this interview like 100 times. So, but you know, when it's still fresh, you got that enthusiasm, you know? I'll definitely subscribe and then listen. Cause I'm always interested in hearing, everything. And, you know, it's like you, I get a ton of emails all the time telling me about, you know, especially pilots and ex-military guys, you know, that's kind of my bag. So, you know, it's fascinating to especially hear it in their own voice and tone. That's what does it for me, is, you know, because it's a very human thing, you know. there's another person that does the same thing that I enjoy too. So it's definitely a format I enjoy.
The reason was because I grew up with listening to like Art Bell and a lot of the older shows. But so I wanted it to kind of be about, you know, someone's experience. When I listen to podcasts where you have a host constantly jumping in all the time and throwing you completely off your account, it really annoyed me. So this way, the idea was just to create a long form approach where people can, you know, just share their experience, you know, naturally and more hopefully more candidly. And it gets a very good reception. I get a lot of people are very happy, just love the way it's actually done. And that kind of approach really helps other people then come forward. So someone will hear you and on the episode, and then they will come forward and say, you know, I think I'm ready to come forward, or, you know, so it, every episode I release, I get a ton more emails of people that then want to come on. Admittedly, I do turn away a lot of the kind of figureheads in the field, you know, the researchers and the people that just kind of just want to hack a book.
Yeah.
Because that's a little bit unfair to the listeners to be constantly selling stuff. Admittedly, you're going to have people who are selling a book based on their experience. I'm cool with that. That's no problem. But when it comes to researchers, I just want to sell a book.
Well, that's not what your podcast is about. So, I mean, it's perfectly all right for you to, you know, not worry about the hawkers.
Yeah.
I mean, when it comes down to it, everybody's got an angle. You know, I mean, for me, you know, it's exposure. It's getting people exposed to my event and things that happen because I'm so involved with, with especially with our company and stuff like that. And, you know, mostly I just want to keep it genuine. And so I appreciate things like this. You know, that's why I like this, you know, the podcasts like you and UFO Garage and, you know, some of these other podcasters that are just, you know, they're just really happy just to hear the story. You know, it is a bit refreshing. Now, I will say I do like the challenging ones too, where they've, you know, really done their homework and they're asking me some nitty gritty questions, making me think about stuff. But yeah, I do enjoy those, just a simple fact, because when that happens, it generally will make my brain actually generate things that I didn't know I remembered, you know, so I'll actually remember new things, which actually helps me, you know, try to figure out another piece of the puzzle, because you never know what you can remember, you know, because obviously you don't know everything that you've forgotten.
That's true. That is true. I really appreciate you coming on today, Gary, and sharing that for our listeners.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And, you know, bless you and your family, and you have a good evening.
And I will be watching, but good luck at this year's Contact in the Desert.
Oh, thank you very much.
That is all for today. Keep updated and connected with the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you've had an encounter you would like to share on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com or reach out to me via the contact page on my website, ufochroniclespodcast.com. A big thank you to Gary for sharing tonight, and thank you for listening. I will be back next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.